the whole month.
Pacifica owned and listener supported for over 50 years. This is 90.1 KPFT and FM HD1 Houston.
That it is 5 p.m. Thursday and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling. We are aired only on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM here in Houston or kpft.org on the internet. I'm Mary Edgerton, tonight's host, and along with the best team on radio, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers whose stories take us on journeys through the windows of their souls, on fanciful trips amid worlds of enchantment, before returning us safely to the present. Tonight, I have for you a set of remarkable storytellers with remarkable stories. You will laugh. You will cry. You will smile with unbelievable joy. I promise that you will feel emotions from triumph through survival. So sit tight. You might want to grab a box of tissues. And now let's get started. Abel Lois, my first guest tonight, is a storyteller, a podcaster, and in his spare time, he likes to ride his bike, spend time with friends and family, cook, and that is a favorite one, play piano, and offer coaching on career and job changes. In fact, his very remarkable story tonight is about a major life change for Abel. Abel.
Hi there.
Share that story with us.
Okay, I will. Thank you. Thanks for the intro. So I've titled this story, The Year of Joy. Wow. My parents were so happy. They were lovebirds. When they were in the same room together, they couldn't stop holding hands. They couldn't stop kissing. They couldn't stop telling each other, I love you. As parents, they never gave me the talk, but I did hear them a lot, at night. It's like they never slept. My parents didn't have much, but they didn't let that define their happiness. My parents treated each other and supported each other, and that is really what defined their happiness. I knew that when I got married, my marriage was going to be just as great. And like all good parents, they set me up for failure. My expectations were so far off. For years, I knew my marriage was doomed. Last August, we finally separated. The emotional journey was brutal. If the body keeps the score, the marriage was killing my body. I'd been anxious and depressed, and at its peak, my whole body was falling apart. There was days my back was so angry I couldn't even stand up straight. I had developed an uncontrollable twitch. We were making one last reconciliation attempt, and one November morning, I met my ex for brunch on a Sunday. She was on the attack, and I sat with her in the restaurant. My shoulder started to twitch uncontrollably. She knew what caused it, but she couldn't help herself, and the monologue at the moment continued. Eventually, the food would arrive, and my shoulder was shaking out of control. To pass time the moment, I tried to take a bite of the food, and as soon as I did, I knew that I was about to choke on it. I excused myself and walked away from the table and into the parking lot, and I spat out the food. I knew I couldn't get into my car because it'd be too confined, and it would trigger a panic attack. I spotted a picnic table across the parking lot at another business, and I went there. I sat on the bench, and my whole body was now shaking. After a while, my muscles were tired, so I decided to lay on the picnic table bench. That was a terrible decision. I lost full control. I could hear the tapping of my feet against the bench. My knees were knocking together. My body was shaking, and my back was banging against the table. My arms were twitching uncontrollably in front of my body. My head was shaking, and saliva dribbled down my face, followed by snot from my nose and tears from my eyes. This went on for about an hour. The message from my body was clear. There would be no reconciliation. As the calendar flipped to 2022, I knew that this would be one of the hardest years of my life as we started down this path to divorce. But rather than accepting that it was just going to be terrible, I rejected the idea. I proclaimed 2022 the year of joy. So many great things have happened this year, but I only have enough time to tell you about one of them. So the very few days into the new year, my good friend Christina called me, and she asked me if I still wanted to launch a comedy podcast that we called Everyday Idiots. During the recording of our very first episode, I shared how much I love meeting strangers, and she shared her love for Party City. In a moment of foreshadowing, we eventually brought these two ideas together. We walked into a party city with just a silly attitude, hoping to meet some strangers. It was pretty quiet that afternoon, so we found ourselves posing with props and trying on products while snapping a few pics. Then an unsuspecting customer turns the corner, which is how we met Paige. We asked if we could help her, and thankfully Christina knew the layout of the store. We helped her find what she needed and found ourselves in a silly conversation about a party Paige was planning. Before we knew it, we got an unexpected invitation to a cheese parade. The cheese parade was just a few days later on a Saturday morning. We had no idea what we had gotten ourselves into. Not having too much time to prepare, I showed up in a bright orange wig and a blue coat. I was a blue cheese ball. Christina was decked in a 70s themed look with furry leg warmers. She was that 70s cheese. We found ourselves at a stranger's house on the east side and walked around into the backyard. We were met by every cheese-related costume you could imagine. There was Baby Bell, cheese-eating rats. There was American cheese. There was Mary Manchega. And of course, the Lord of Cheese himself, Jesus Christ. We were gritting ear to ear, living in the moment, and the fun hadn't even started yet. You can't have a cheese parade without first having communion. Yes, there was a Gregorian chant playing with a tapping of a gong, incense burning inside of a cheese grater dangling by a string, and eventually the blessing over the body and blood of cheeses, chips, and queso. After taking communion, all 50 of us walked out in the street, which included several homemade floats. One of them was a cauldron of queso that hit a speaker with a queued-up playlist. The cheese jester ran to the front of the pack, pulled out a huge string cheese, and started billowing yellow smoke as he danced back and forth across the street as the parade started its course. We danced in the streets, we sang along as this unsanctioned parade flooded East Austin. This unusual-looking parade stopped traffic in its tracks, yet no one was annoyed. Instead, they'd pull over, take pictures and video. How could anyone be upset with this crazy experience unfolding in front of their unsuspecting eyes? At least when they showed up late, they had a great story to tell. Christina and I were overcome with joy. Our faces were tired from smiling so much. We didn't know what we were onto, but we knew we had just experienced something special. So to no surprise, this year has been filled with ups and downs. And happiness isn't a destination, rather a journey. By inviting joy, it's made a massive difference in being able to find it in early and very often. And more than anything, I have found that the more I work to bring joy to other people, the more it's returned to me.
Will you move in next door to me? And I have to tell you, we have one of the best cheese stores, I think, if anywhere. I always call it the Houston Dairy Cheese Maids, but it's the Houston Cheese Dairy Maids. And they have a selection of artisan cheeses, you know, from all over. And So when you are in Houston again, I think we should have a little mini cheese celebration.
That would
And I will bring some cheese. And in the meantime, I'm going to email you when I'm feeling down and I need a story. That was both wonderful and a wonderful way to talk about dealing with a terrific life change. I know I've done it twice. As I
Oh,
say, I am the Elizabeth Taylor of my family.
wow. No, you're professional at this point.
Yes. It is a tremendous transition, and it really takes a mindset to go forward. So that was very positive.
Well, I have to tell you that, as you probably know very well, that it is really emotionally taxing. There have been many, many dark, challenging days along the way, and it was really a matter of like, who do you surround yourself with? And it's one thing to surround yourself with amazing people, but it's another thing to also not be the one that brings everyone down, but rather to bring everybody up. And that doesn't come from being fake. It's literally that mindset that you're talking about. And sometimes even still, I'm feeling down and I need to call a friend, or I need to go and do something. I need to hop on my bike, or I need to cook for somebody. And these are things that kind of work me out of whatever that poor mindset is in the moment.
Also, I have to say, I was born in Austin, Texas, and I absolutely love that place because where else would there be a cheese parade?
Well, that concept was born out of New Orleans,
Oh,
and
really? Okay.
it's one of the many parades. So the thing about New Orleans is there's always a parade, right? And so the cheese parade is one of the many parades that lead up to Mardi Gras.
Right.
And I don't know how well known it is, whether in New Orleans or elsewhere, but there was a so Paige, who we met at Party City, she was from New Orleans. And one of her big complaints about Austin is that there's not enough parades. So she decided that her and her husband were going to host this parade. And it was the second annual cheese parade here in Austin. And I think last year's was interfered by the big ice storm. And they maybe had, 10 or so people out there. But this year they had, I'm going to say, at least 50 people out there. And every time I tell the stories about the cheese parade, people ask me, how do I go? Can I sign up? Is there a mailing list? So it might be a much bigger deal next year. We will see.
All right. Well, I will definitely keep in touch. And you also mentioned that you play piano, and you happen to know Christina Faust, and she will be one of my storytelling guests next month in October. I believe y'all are collaborating on some pieces.
We are. So she has an amazing and beautiful voice that has this incredible range to it. And so what we're working on right now is a few different Adele pieces. And we're going to start with just doing some open mic nights and work our way into doing some gigs.
All right. Well,
And
I'm
so
gonna.
that is the plan. We actually went to a open mic, I think Tuesday of this past week, just to observe and get a feel for it and that sort of thing. And I think she'll very easily be the top act at an open
Okay.
mic night, because her singing is just so incredible.
And before we close, how do people access your podcast?
So Everyday Idiots can be found on your favorite platforms. YouTube, Spotify, and Apple are the primary.
Okay, I will look for that. I always enjoy a good podcast. And so,
Fantastic.
thank you, Abel Lomas, for that wonderful story of triumph and survival. It really was great. And now I'm going to bring on another guest, someone that we know well here at KPFT. That's Nadia Hakim. And she has a story of triumph, which I think has contributed to her overall survival. I want you to know Nadia is one of my favorite people. She is currently the Deputy Director of Communications for the Elections Office. And believe you me, I have plenty to say about how I feel about those paper ballots, especially that one that got caught in the paper machine that was supposed to record what I had recorded and created a mess. And they tried to treat me like I was some old lady who didn't know about IT and couldn't handle it. And I just, anyway, I have lodged an informal complaint with you. Just tell them to be nice to old people. We're not that slow.
I'm sure that was a great lesson in customer service, Mary. So thank you for giving them a run for their money.
But anyway, I know that you have a wonderful story. Right now, you're the Deputy Director of Communications for the Elections Office. So you're the face of communications for elections in Harris County, I guess.
I've been on a couple of the commercials, and then I do a lot of the voiceovers, but also like interviews and things like this, and a lot of community outreach. It's really great. I really do love my job.
But this is not the first time that you've been the face of an institution before. I mean, this is not the first time, and you have a before time, and I'm hoping you'll tell us about that first time where you became the face of another institution.
Right. This was my accidental claim to fame that you're referring to. But to get to that story, we have to start at the beginning, right? And
always.
Growing up, I always knew I was different. But it wasn't super apparent until I got to maybe the third, fourth grade, and all the girls in class were talking about how cute Jeff was. And I just didn't get it. Like, Stephanie was really pretty. How come we weren't talking about that? And then boy bands, right? That came right after that little bit. And everyone was in this frenzy over boy bands. And I was definitely more drawn to the Spice Girls. But like, I always had like a default answer in case anyone brought it up, because I didn't want people thinking I was weird, right? So I always stayed ready to fight over how hot Lance Bass was from NSYNC, and we know how that all turned out because we're both now out and proud, right? So I came out at the end of my senior year of high school, and it was just such an amazing feeling. And here I was, you know, at such an important start of like a new beginning, right? Like, I was getting ready to go to college, and I had scholarships, and I had a new car, but like, best of all, here I was living my truth, and it just didn't get any better than that. There was such a huge lift off my shoulders, and a lot happened in that transition summer between high school and college. And one of those things being that the university I was going to attend, they sent out an email saying that they were updating their marketing materials, and any student who participated, especially incoming freshmen, you would get a free lunch and a t-shirt. So I was sold. So I show up to this small photo shoot that they were hosting on campus, and there are about a dozen other people, and they sit us in the classroom, and we are raising our hands. We're just having a normal discussion about life, and we're simulating like a classroom discussion, right? And the photographer is running around taking photos, and it was over before you know it. And I almost forgot about it immediately because, again, so many things were happening that summer. I started dating my first girlfriend shortly after that. I was working part-time, trying to hang out with all my friends before we left for school. And before they left for school, rather, I stayed in Houston. And then once school started, there were a lot of things I had to get acclimated to. One of them being that I was going to be attending a conservative Catholic university, right? So that was one. And then the next big thing was that this was like during the shift to digital. So all my class assignments were online, all my grades were online, reading discussions and things like that, those were all posted online. And this was probably my first encounter with internet trolls, was in one of these classroom discussions online. It was a discussion board for like catechism 101 or teaching of the Catholic Church, something like this, one of my required theology classes. And there were a couple of students who had posted things along the lines of you can pray the gay away, or homosexuality, it's like drug addiction. And I think one of the worst things about this was my teacher could see it, my classmates could see it, but nobody was saying anything. Like, I had people who said things to me outside of class and that sort of thing, but like nobody was standing up for me on these boards. But I had really good friends on campus who helped me pull through. They always celebrated who I was no matter what. And because of them, you know, I survived my fall semester, my first semester of college, and spring semester came around. And I received a really interesting voicemail from a friend who I hadn't heard from since high school. And it went something along the lines of, "Hey girls, I was just at First Colony Mall in Sugarland, and I saw you on an advertisement for your school, and I thought it was the coolest thing. Anyways, miss you, hope to catch up soon, blah, blah, blah." At the end of the message, I hang up, and of course, my interest is piqued. I was like, how cool is it that she was able to pick me out on this advertisement? So I turned to my friend who I was studying with at the time, and I said, "Hey, do you want to go look for my face at First Colony Mall in Sugarland?" And they said, "Oh, absolutely, let's go." So we went to the library, we printed out the directions and the map, which is a very old-fashioned sentence now, I realize. So we printed that out because neither of us had ever gone out there before to this mall. And we show up, we park, and we walk in through the food court entrance. And they have all these little, not little, but they have the tall screens in the middle of the walkways going on either side. And before we can even come up with a plan on how we're going to tackle this, within seconds of us walking in, all the screens to our right, and then all the screens to our left, all of a sudden have my racially ambiguous, just like full of merriment and wonder. And I'm like looking off to the side of the camera and just like so intrigued by whatever I'm learning. And it's just me. And there are like two, three other people in the frame as well, but they were either covered by the logo, or they were blurred out, or they were cut off a little bit. So a good bit of the focus was on me, and it was really weird. And it only got weirder after that, because more phone calls would come in about, "Oh, I saw you printed out on a poster at this college fair," or, "Oh, I saw you at this mall," "Oh, I saw you in this magazine," "Oh, I saw you in the back of this newspaper." And my Filipino family, all devout Catholics, they found out I was a full page ad on the back of the Texas Catholic Herald, and they were like stealing like their neighbors' copies of the newspaper like off their driveways. It's like, doesn't that go against one of your like 10 Rocky Rule stone tablet things, like the don't steal please, or whatever it is, you know? And it was really, really weird. And they used these photos in advertisements and the student handbook for like 7-8 years, for a good while. And anyone who hears this story or finds this out, they always ask me, "Oh my God, what did you get paid for doing this?" And I tell them, a free t-shirt and a cold turkey sandwich and a bag of chips. And it's always the same reaction, just, "Are you kidding me? Shouldn't you be making royalties off of this?" And so on and so forth. And young Nadia definitely was like, "Yeah, maybe I could have made some serious money. You know, it was a private institution. Maybe, maybe." But then I think about it really hard, and I don't know that any amounts of money would have brought me more joy than knowing that, like, my homophobic classmates had to sit there and look at my face, my non-Catholic, out and proud gay face, you know, as a representative of our school. And, like, not only during the entire time that we were there, right, but even well after graduation. So I don't know, you can't put a price on your truth, and that's what I've got.
I love that story. Great seeing you, and thanks for being on the show. Well, more to come, but let's pause now for station identification. We are a community-based storytelling radio show broadcast on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston Community Radio, also broadcast at 91.9 in Huntsville, 89.5 in Galveston, and anywhere on the internet as kpft.org. Our show, So What's Your Story?, is broadcast every Thursday at 5 p.m. Central Time and will be until September 28th, when we will move to Wednesdays at 6 p.m. But not to worry, we will keep you appraised of the situation as the time comes closer. And if you miss us, or if you just want to hear a show again or send it to someone, you can visit our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, at HoustonStorytellers.org, where you can replay any of our previous shows from So What's Your Story by selecting the radio show tab. Want to become a storyteller? Join the Houston Storytellers Guild and attend their monthly swap on the fourth Tuesday of the month. Check out their calendar tab and grab the Zoom information for the next virtual swap, which is coming up on Tuesday, September 27th. The theme will be Schooled. Another way to get into storytelling is by joining the Texas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network. You can find them at Texas, and that's T-E-J-A-S, storytelling.com. Our friends at The Moth are back at Warehouse Live in person for several months now. They're back on schedule for the second Tuesday of the month. The next show is October 11th with the theme Grown. Check out their Facebook page, The Moth in Houston, for updates on their next storytelling slam. Speaking of Facebook, you can find us at So What's Your Story on Facebook. Please visit us, so yes, and please like us. You can suggest storytellers or themes that right there on Facebook. And now, let's curl up and get comfortable. Let's get back to why we're here. Let's travel to Storyland again. And now I have another very special guest with a very remarkable story for you, Chris Bybee Finley. Chris has lived throughout the world, but is now retired and lives in Houston. She's a writer, a knitter. I mentioned she's retired. She was an award-winning teacher, a world traveler, and she currently actually works with the American Association of University Women. And she's also a very naturally lucky person. And she has a remarkable story for us of recovery. So can you share that with us, Chris?
Oh, Mary, thank you so much for inviting me onto your show. I really appreciate that and being able to share this story. And it is a story I've told a lot because it really affected me, affected our family, affected everything about us. It's always in the back of our minds. And this is seven and a half years ago. We're getting ready to gather in Florida for a Christmas vacation, the whole family. And I get a phone call at about 10 o'clock at night from someone I didn't know. And they said, your daughter had an incident and she is in the hospital. And I screamed my husband's name and he ran down the stairs. And I said, you know, because I wasn't able to handle whatever was coming by myself. And we listened and they said she had, Anne is her name, a wonderful, wonderful young woman. and had a sudden cardiac arrest, and they said that she is they're sustaining her right now, and they couldn't tell me anything else. We called the hospital. This person told us that she was at the Cayuga Hospital and had been taken there. Called the hospital. They couldn't give us any information, of course, except the fact that they were maintaining her, you know, and that was it. That's all they could say. We said, we're on our way. We notified her partner and he was flying up from Florida. He was already in Florida. And we get on the plane. But before we got on the plane, we packed our luggage and we packed for a funeral, because sudden cardiac arrest is, the fatality rate is incredibly high. And all I could think of was that they were maintaining her because they wanted us to be there to donate, be able to say to donate the organs. And that's all I could think of, was getting on the plane and getting there. And I don't remember much except for the fact that my husband had to lead me through every airport terminal to fly into Ithaca. He had to lead me because I was weeping and weeping and weeping. And there was no getting around that dread. And I was going to incredible sadness. We were met at the airport by a wonderful woman who worked for Cornell University. And she was there as a social guide for us. And she took us to the hospital. And we see our daughter in the rooms, just plugged into everything. And we had no idea, you know, what was there in terms of who she was. And that was, I stopped crying and my husband just completely broke down. He was just totally devastated. And we found out the story slowly about how Anne came to be in that position, in that bed at that time. She had just defended her master's thesis successfully. And a brilliant person that she is, she lost her keys. And so she could not get into her house. But friends called her and said, hey, you should be out celebrating with us instead of going home or trying to get into her home and being by herself. She was out with friends at an Airbnb, lovely bar. And they were all celebrating. And she doesn't drink. She's allergic to alcohol. So she's not a person who indulges. And they were all together and she slumped. And everyone noticed at the same time that she was gone. And they were on the phone immediately. They laid her out so that they could do whatever they could. And they called 911 and the fire department and the EMTs were there within a matter of minutes. It was a 3-minute drive from the fire station. But what else happened was that there was a doctor at the bar at the time, and he looked over and he said, oh, they're having fun. No, they're not. Something's wrong. And he went over immediately and he saw that she had stopped breathing. Her heart had stopped. And he started CPR on her immediately. And I met this wonderful doctor later on. He was a physician at Cornell. And he said the day before he had been recertified for CPR. And the other reason why he was there was because Friday night he went to his regular place to meet with friends. And there was a sign on the door saying, we're closed tonight. And so he said, I went to Argo. I went to this Airbnb bar. And that's why I was there and not in my regular place. So it was just amazing. I get all of this information over the months afterwards, that all of this was put together. And it was just totally miraculous. So the firefighters come in, they take over, they start her heart. The EMTs, they've intubated her, they put her in an ambulance. And just by chance, that ambulance has the ability to chill the body. What it does is it chills the body completely so that the organs slow down. They are not stressed. So they have Arcosec in the ambulance, not at the hospital. So they get her and they've chilled her and they get her to the Cayuga Hospital. People are there for her. They have, you know, kept her alive and they've kept her chilled. And they are now going to go through the process of raising her temperature now that they could help her with her heart. You know, she was all connected to any wires and every wire that I have no idea what that was. So we are there with her. She's still chilled in a chilled state because you can chill them fast, but you can't defrost them, as they say. Can't defrost them in a hurry. And the other person who has joined us at this time is our daughter, Karen, who is, just by chance, a cardiovascular ICU nurse who helped us through this whole process, talking to the doctors, talking to the nurses, watching the monitors for her sister. They checked to see the organs seem to be doing fine. And what we're worried about and what we're concerned about is that we don't know what has affected her brain, because we have no idea if she can move, if she can talk, if she can do anything, because she is chilled. We meet Kenny, who was first on the scene. I ran across the room. He says, "I never run, but she's our girl. She's our girl." And she kept saying that, and he kept visiting, and he was saying, "How's our girl? How's our girl?" Because he said, "Nobody survives this." He says, "I didn't tell you that." He told us that later. He says, "Nobody survives." And that's why they were, the whole firefighting department was just so engaged in making sure that she was doing okay and that we were doing okay. Anything that we wanted, they were there for us. And then we've taken over the waiting room at the hospital. And I realized later that everything had been coordinated. There was always food there for us. There were always people there for us. Her department companions, her, you know, people she worked with, people she studied with, people she taught, her mentor, department heads, they were all there. Just coordinate. They recycled through to make sure that we were never alone. 24 hours a day, there was always, her friends were there. The friends she was out with camped out. We literally camped out in that waiting room. But it was just an amazing amount of care and love from that community during our stay there. And so what they were tried to do numerous times was to raise Anne's temperature to get her to normal temperatures. But every time they raised her temperature a little bit, they found that she had just flaming infection somewhere, and they couldn't figure out what it was. So they would raise her temperature, infections, lower the temperature, because they couldn't figure out where the infection was. And we let her know, they asked us, "Where has she been?" And we're like, "Oh my God, you know, she spent a year in Mexico. She's traveled throughout South America. She spent a summer in Ghana. She lived overseas. She studied in Morocco. She studied in Vienna. She's traveled around the Middle East. She's, you know, it's just like, where did this infection come from?" We went through her history over and over and over again. They were just trying to find where that infection, what could be causing that. We could never, you know, antibiotics, but they had to be careful about her medicines. They had to be careful about everything in terms of how to treat her. And they did such an incredible job with that. And then finally, a week of this, of looking, you know, sitting with her, being with her, talking to her all the time, and going in and just being by her side and talking to her. And we kept kept telling her she was welcome back to us. She was welcome back to us. And it was an incredible time of care, like I said, care and love and concern. And then we were in the way in the room, and one of the nurses came in. She rushed in. She literally rushed in. And she said, you know, because we knew the cycles of when they tried to raise her temperature to see, and they had raised her temperature to check everything. Everything was working. We still didn't know if her brain was working. We didn't know if anything was functioning there. Everything, you know, so had no indication at all. And what happened was this nurse, like I said, rushed in, and she said, we've raised her temperature, and she's reaching some kind of consciousness. And I'm looking at her, and I said, Anne, and she says, does she know sign language? Does she know sign language? And I said, yes. Yes, she does. Anne and Karen had placemats when they were young, and they learned how to sign the alphabet so that they could talk to each other in church or in secret in the back seat of the car. And so, yes, so they knew sign language. And the nurse looked at me and she goes, do you know sign language? And I said, no, I don't. And I went and found Karen. Karen was taking a break from sitting next to her sister. I said, Karen, I said, the nurse wants you to go in. They think Anne is signing. And so Karen goes in, dear, incredibly wonderful Karen. And she goes in and she sees her sister moving her fingers. And it was such a sign. Such a sign that her brain was working, that her brain could work and remembered how to do this. And Karen saw that she was asking where. And Karen, with all the love of the sister, said, you're in the hospital. Get some rest. Go back to sleep. So I thought, yes, sisters. And so that was an incredible sign for us that all of the organs were working, including the brain. And the next several days, they kept raising her temperature, and they saw that she was not had no infection. The infections were pretty much gone. And on Christmas morning, we walked in to the hospital room, and she had her eyes open, and she smiled at us. And we waved to her. And that is how Anne came back to us.
Oh my gosh. I what a wonderful Christmas present.
It was.
Well, let me introduce our next guest, Lynn Skatanko. Lynn has been an IT manager at Shell Oil for over a decade, let's say. He's also a reservist, a first lieutenant in the Texas State Guard, and his mission is primarily civil affairs. So any of you who've suffered through a hurricane, or if we all remember a Storm Uri and the terrible freeze, it would be Lynn's group that would be out helping out. Lynn's married. He has three children. The last one's about to finish high school. And Lynn, you know, along with other things that you've told me about yourself, you were a football coach.
Indeed, I sort of was, but we'll get to that. My son, Seth, was born with a rare genetic condition. He was missing the tip of the long arm of the 10th chromosome. When he was born, he was about the 30th person in the world diagnosed with it. As we sat with the doctors who diagnosed it, we asked, so what does this look like? And they said, well, look, we really don't know. He's not going to die from it. but he will need some sort of therapy all through his life. He'll need speech therapy, he'll need physical therapy, and he'll need occupational therapy. And so we set out on a journey to give him as many opportunities as we could for him to be treated like a normal kid. So we put him in therapy and we worked with him, but we made sure that he was in regular classes and did a lot of activities. But, you know, we always saw that he was physically behind most of his peers, especially when it came to motor skills, fine motor skills, gross motor skills, he was always behind. So in fifth grade, he comes to us and says, I want to play full contact football. Okay. And my wife looked at me and said, the only way that's going to happen is if I coach him. Well, I've never played football, let alone coach football. But there I am, day one, as the defensive coordinator of his fifth grade team. We get out for the first day of practice, and I'm watching my son, Seth, and he was everything I was nervous he was going to be. He wasn't as fast as his teammates. He wasn't very coordinated. And I'm picturing the typical athlete, and I just was afraid he was going to get ridiculed. I was afraid that the other players were going to start making fun of him. I was afraid that he would just ride the bench constantly. Slowly but surely, I watched the team adjust to him. The quarterback would hand the ball to him a little slower. They'd throw the ball to him a little softer. And little did I know that the most accepted I'd see my special needs son is between the sidelines of a football field. We got into the season and he would start to play. And I can remember early in the season, he went out as a defensive back. And the other team had some pretty tall kids, but even at that, one of the guys carrying the football runs up and approaches Seth, and he hits Seth so hard that he went straight horizontal over the field. And when I say horizontal, it was like out of a movie. He just floated above the field before he fell and crashed. And he came over to me on the sidelines and he looked at me, and I had one of the hardest moments I ever had as his father and his coach. And I said, Seth, are you okay? And he said, no. And I said, what's wrong? And he said, it just hurts. And he looked at me and he said, can I have a hug? And I looked at him and I said, no, you can't. And I told him, I'm your coach right now. I'm not your dad. You got to go sit down. You got to shake it off. And you got to get back up and keep playing. Seth, as a man, a young man, went over and sat down. And we progressed through the season, and Seth would play. You know, he'd go out on the field and he'd run around as wide receiver. We didn't give him the ball, and he was happy with that. I was happy with that. I didn't want to see him get knocked across the field. About halfway through the season, the head coach came to me with the playbook. He opened it up, and there it was. West Virginia, tight right, 38, toss sweep. Seth's play. I looked at him and I said, Terry, you're crazy. He looked at me and he said, listen, we're going to play Seth in a play. And I said, Terry, I don't think this is a good idea. He's not ready for it. I don't think the team is ready for it. I started talking to Seth about it. And sure enough, he wasn't ready for it. He's like sitting there, no, I'm not doing this. And I said, Seth, coach wants to do it. I want to do it. And what was great was as the players found out about it, they wanted to do it. We would get toward the game at the end of the week and the players would go, are we doing the Seth play? Are we doing the Seth play? And coach would say, I don't know. We're going to try. And we got to the last home game of the season and coach came to me before the game and he said, okay, today we're going to do the Seth play. Before the game, I went across the field to the opposing coach and I said, hey, coach, we've got a guy on our team. He's a special needs player and we're going to run a play with him. It's just going to be a run out of bounds play. If you could have your defense back up, just don't hit him. He's not going to go anywhere. He just wants to come to the sidelines and run out of bounds. It's just a play we want to run with him. And the coach said, well, we'll see what we can do. And I didn't put a whole lot of faith that that meant anything other than we had just told him what we were going to do at some point. we get towards the end of the game. It's the fourth quarter and we're getting beat bad. I can't remember what the score was, but there was no way we were going to come back and win. But we had the ball and Coach Terry came to me and said, okay, it's time to run the Seth play. And I go over to Seth and I look at him and I said, okay, buddy, you're in. And his eyes got huge, like plates. And he starts shaking his head, no way. And I just slap him on the shoulder blades and I say, get out on the field. And I run across the field to the other side and there's the coach. And I yell to him, hey, we're going to do our play. And I turn to go back to the huddle. And I hear the coach yell, Auburn, Auburn. And I look towards his defense and they just start backing up. And I knew then that he had told his defense what was going to happen and told them, just let him run his play. I ran to the huddle where my son had gotten there. And I'm ready to give him, you know, the suck it up speech, be a man, you could do this. Don't be scared, it's fine. And right as I'm about to say all of that, off to the sidelines, I hear his team chanting, let's go, Seth, let's go, over and over. And I look at him right in his eyes, and all I said was, Seth, do you hear that? That's for you. Take the ball and run to me. I'll be right on the sidelines. Just cross the sideline. Seth has this look on his face like, dear God, why am I here? And I run off the field and I get to the side and I turn around and I hear the quarterback yell, ready, set, hike. And in my head, I can picture everything that could go wrong. He could drop the ball. He could fall. He could trip over his own players. And all of the things that I think could go bad don't happen. The quarterback hands the ball to my son and he runs towards the sideline and his eyes are going everywhere looking for me. And he finally sees me and he runs as fast as I've ever seen him run right to me, never looking anywhere else. He crosses the sideline and I just remember putting my arms around him and grabbing him as hard as I could. And everyone's cheering and yelling and the referee comes over and he looks at my son and he looks at me and he just puts his hands up and says, that's game. His team starts picking him up and they're hooting and hollering and cheering and yelling and saying, way to go, Seth. That was awesome. And I just remember I walked off the field and I got into my car and I drove all the way home and I made it up the stairs into my bedroom, closed the door and sat on my bed and cried like a baby. Never in my life did I think one of my happiest moments would be something that I never even did. But as long as I live, I will never forget West Virginia, tight right, 38, toss sweep.
You know, my eyes started welling up with tears when you started referring to it as the Seth play. I don't know how many people out there in Radio Land have the tears streaming down their cheeks like me. And I can only imagine how hard it was for you to get all the way up the stairs to let those tears flow. That is a beautiful story.
Thank you.
Everything about it, your team, your coach, your son, and the other team, just wonderful. Yeah.
You know, I will tell you, the world is a difficult place sometimes, but there are moments where I think everything gets redeemed. And when I think of that moment, that was certainly a day in my life that I thought, you know, there's always going to be good in this world. There are people who love each other and there are people that will rally around someone when they need something. And, you know, he still talks about it. He loves when I tell the story, Dad, tell the Seth play, you know, he gets a kick out of it. So I was super proud of him. And I told him, I said, you know, courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is doing it in the face of fear. And so he was very courageous that day, and I was very proud. I'm still very proud of him.
Everybody, take a deep breath. Life is good. Joy is within our reach. Miracles happen. Hank will be at the helm next week with more tellers and new journeys. But don't leave. Stay tuned into KPFT, because Charles Hightower's R&B Gold is up next with a soothing mix of music as a balm for your soul.
Make Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1, a part of every day. And while you're driving home or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 5 p.m. for So What's Your Story? It's a great way to make the commute go by. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't end the way you want, it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. Ooh, it's something magical. It's in the air, it's in my blood, it's rushing on. Rushing on. I don't need no reason, don't be control. I'll fly so high, no ceiling when I'm in my zone. Cause I got that sunshine in my pocket, got that good soul in my feet. I feel that hot blood in my body when it drops. Ooh, I can't take my eyes off of it, moving so phenomenally. Boom, I rock the way we rock it, so don't stop.
When you dance, 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 dance. Feel the good creeping up on you, so just dance, dance, dance. sense I shouldn't do, but you